All right. Well, good afternoon, everybody. We appreciate you joining us as always. This is Corey Worden. I'm the administrator for the ASSP Healthcare Practice Specialty, and you're listening to the Health Beat podcast as always. So today we got a great episode. Today we're talking to Charity Dominguez, who works over at the City of Houston Office of Emergency Management. So they've done all kinds of great work with us over the last couple of years with the COVID-19 pandemic and planning shelter, hard freeze, cold weather shelters during pandemic conditions and tropical storms and hurricanes and all kinds of different things all during these situations. So they do just a fantastic job, and she's got a great amount of experience and a prolific career. So we're excited to have her on today. So Charity, short of me speaking for you, if you can give our listeners just a little bit about yourself, your career, education, certifications, anything that you'd like to talk about, we appreciate that. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Corey. And thanks for that awesome introduction. I don't know if I'm going to do myself as much justice as you did. So
my name is Charity Dominguez. I am what is called the UWASI, or the Houston UWASI Regional Training and Exercise Coordinator. And UWASI stands for the Urban Area Security Initiative. The city of Houston is we are one of 32 metropolitan areas that receive UWASI funding because we are considered, you know, like at a high threat for terrorism. So most of my training and exercise is supposed to be, or is really designed for anti-terrorist threats. But I am able to work with the rest of our region, which is the city of Houston and our five surrounding counties, including Harris County, which we're in, being able to assist with a lot of the training exercises that they do as well. So I actually am pretty new to emergency management compared to a lot of my colleagues. So I actually started working in emergency management with one of our neighboring counties back in November of 2017. So prior to that, I worked with the homeless of Houston Harris County for 12 years. And so that kind of like geared me up for, a career in emergency management, basically going from crisis management and really being a public servant to our homeless population to being able to be a public servant to a larger population. And so I was really, really happy to come and work for the city of Houston back in January of 2019 because I love the city. I love the community. I love the people. We're the greatest city in the United States. Sorry to anybody else. But I feel like anybody who's in this industry needs to, you know, think that their community is the best community ever. I got my master's degree and totally decided to change my career back in 2017 as a master's in public policy with a specialization in emergency management. Since that time, I've been able to work with FEMA and their Emergency Management Institute, which is also the home of the National Fire Academy, which is really amazing place. I recommend anybody who's able to attend the Emergency Management Institute to do so. It's really an amazing experience. It's a great way to learn a lot more about emergency management, and especially being, you know, part of the first responder community. And working with the Emergency Management Institute, I received kind of a second master's. It's definitely regarded pretty highly in the emergency management world as a master's in exercise practitioner. And so that means that I follow kind of the Department of Homeland Security template and outline that they feel are the best practices for having exercises. And so basically we conducting exercises. So we have the discussion-based exercises, which I'm sure you're familiar with, but not everybody might be familiar with, which are the tabletop exercise, our workshops, and our seminars. And then, of course, our full-scale exercises, which are more operational-based, and our functional exercises, in which we like deploy assets and actually do a lot of activities for usually 3 to even up to 12 to 24 hours. So we have a really big full-scale exercise coming up. That's a part of a complex coordinated terrorist attack. And I've been able to be part of that. So I think that's about all of myself and career and education.
Awesome. Yeah, that's definitely a lot of great things going on there. And yeah, certainly we certainly always appreciate working with y'all. I know, and we've done the pandemic response for the last couple of years, and then as an extension of that, I've begun working specializing around the chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and explosive hazards. So we'll certainly look forward to working with y'all on all of those things as we continue. So speaking of that, so in terms of emergency management, you know, I know y'all deal with the full spectrum of hazards, you know, of course, natural disasters, major accidents, attacks, WMDs, all different kinds of things. So what type of those situations have you dealt with or planned for or exercised that that affect healthcare or public health type operations?
Yeah, so of course, during this COVID response, we have been very connected to our healthcare providers, our health department, and our safety folks who, as you know, with the City of Houston, are connected with human resources. So I encourage everybody who, you know, who's connected with healthcare, and especially our health department partners, whether they're part of the emergency preparedness team or not, you all are considered first responders, especially during this, you know, pandemic experience that we've been having. But more and more, I've seen a lot of our environmental quality folks, our Harris County, or, you know, other public health people, of course, the City of Houston Health Department. And I've definitely been working closely with our human resource safety folks. And so the trainings that I really like to see a wide variety of disciplines in are of course the trainings that I do, you know, I conduct and facilitate, which are the incident command trainings. And those are our FEMA sponsored trainings that really show how the incident command structure system works with our first responders, and how we can be really a cohesive and coordinated team when it comes to responding to any type of incident, whether it's human created or a natural disaster. And so I've really enjoyed, especially this last year, how there's been a bigger push for our healthcare providers and members of people who are part of the health department and safety that have been attending these classes. And I definitely, you know, this COVID response is going to be kind of a continuous deal. I mean, I'm not seeing any end, you know, in our near future. And so it is essential to have our healthcare folks and our safety people involved in all trainings and exercises, and especially being partners when we activate our emergency operations center. And so we always make sure that there's room at the table for all of our healthcare and public health people. I recently encouraged you, actually, Corey, and another person connected with safety to attend our sporting events and large scale planned events, which, you know, could be concerts or rallies or even, you know, planned protests or any type of large scale incident like that. So we like to make sure that we have a public health presence in trainings like that, and especially safety, because y'all bring a great perspective and a totally different take to the table when it comes to you know, planning for those types of events. Plus, we have to keep in mind, like, our emergency medical services, how this might be part of our public, like how it might affect our public health in any type of event like that. So we always, even with our World Petroleum Conference Congress that we're having right now in the city, even though it's more focused on like our fire and police presence, and especially having our law enforcement, the special operations being present, we do have a person, you know, here with our with the health department to give us updates if there's any problems with vaccination and testing sites right now, and to kind of ensure the safety within our emergency operations center, and that we're making sure that, you know, we're all following like COVID guidelines and making sure that we're, you know, having enough like social distancing and stuff like that. So just to, you know, make sure that we are staying safe too. And of course, there's a whole other aspect, and having our healthcare folks as part of our activation and exercises, that you usually represent a very underserved community and will help advocate for this particular community of people who have disabilities and access functional needs. And so we're able to incorporate that and take a whole community approach when it comes to training and exercise, and keeping that particular vulnerable community in mind when we are doing preparedness and planning for a disaster. And it has been really critical and essential to make sure that we have a whole community at the table when being part of this whole planning process. Also, to add to the exercise portion, I do include our health care workers and also safety in all of our exercises, especially if they're full scale. Mostly with safety, to ensure the safety of my players and actors that are within the exercise, and also to make sure that we are, you know, currently following COVID protocols. We also have a whole full-scale exercise that we have to do annually for our evacuation hub, since we are considered a high risk for a hurricane, as everybody knows. So we are an evacuation city if we have, I think a category 3 or higher hurricane that will have a direct hit on Houston. And so we rely heavily on the health department with the city and also our other local jurisdictions health department, because they are the ones who are registering the folks into our evacuation hub and helping them get onto the buses. So the health department with the police department are the two major players or departments that are actually running the evacuation hub. And when I do the exercise, the health department plays a huge role, because they are not only staffing all the folks for registration, but also any escorts, and of course now with COVID protocols, doing temperature screening, making sure that people have their proper PPE, and you know, maintaining that social distancing and stuff like that. So that's about it on exercises too.
Yeah, that's awesome. Definitely a lot of moving parts and a lot of good preparedness there. All very important. Yeah, I noticed how you mentioned the preparedness for, you know, major events and everything. And it's been such a thing because, you know, of course, there's been a pandemic going on for almost 2 years now. And so that brings in, you know, of course, the capacity management and distancing and source control and all those different factors. And so should there be a need for medical attention, then that brings in the potential for disease exposure prevention and respiratory protection and biowaste disposal and contamination control. So there's a lot of factors with that. And then as you know, sadly, there's the Astro World situation that had happened on November 5th. And that kind of adds a whole different layer to it, you know, in terms of life safety and a whole different dimension of, you know, capacity management and whatnot, especially with the triage and, you know, identifying people that are in need of CPR and having the proper AED preparedness and all the different factors there. Have you noticed in the last couple weeks, has there been a big push for discussions and increased preparedness around large congregations and things of that nature around that situation?
Yeah, so most definitely. And we have we're actually preparing for the Houston Marathon. We're finally doing that back in person, and it will be, I think, right at the beginning of January, or the mid-January, sorry. It's usually Martin Luther King, like over Martin Luther King weekend. So historically, that particular event, even though it's planned and, you know, we've always done it annually, even pre-COVID, it was kind of like the makings, it could be the makings of the perfect storm. So our weather here in Houston, as you know, is very temperamental. So sometimes it's, you know, 70 degrees in January, and sometimes it's in the 30s, which is, I know it might not be so cold for some folks who are maybe listening, but that's really cold for us. On top of, you know, like 70% humidity, which is just a different kind of cold. So we have the potential to have like a serious public health situation. So we've had like issues before to have the Martin Luther King parades are the day after the marathon. So we're still kind of, you know, recovering from being activated for a few days for the marathon and all the events that happen with that. And then we have two MLK parades that happen actually simultaneously. So when you also factor in like the weather, so a few years ago, pre-COVID, it feels like a decade ago, but I think it was the 2019 marathon, we actually had some a cold snap. And so you know, with the marathon, half the city is closed down. So we have a lot of road closures. We have a lot of other situations going on. And also we, you know, most of downtown is just focused on the marathon. And since we had that cold snap, then we had to figure out what we needed to do for our vulnerable population. So we do, unfortunately, have a large homeless population that is, you know, living on the streets or in encampments. And then anybody who may be like a senior or other vulnerable populations that may have some socioeconomic situations where they can't have heat, or they may, I mean, as we know with our severe cold weather back in February, we were without power for several days at a time. And you know, that caused a whole other problems for, you know, escalating problems, especially with our emergency medical services. So we want to be prepared for that type of situation where we had to kind of scramble and open up some warming centers, maybe have some overnight shelters, working really closely with our homeless service providers and getting that word out to our homeless population about like where they could go when these really cold temperatures were expected. And, you know, dealing with all of that, also with the huge influx of folks coming in from all over, because the Houston Marathon is a qualifying marathon for the Boston and New York Marathon. So we do have a large group of out-of-towners coming in. So we have this huge influx of people, and then a whole other like separate population that we have to kind of scramble and take care of. So, you know, a lot of our preparedness and recovery and response has been working closely with you know, all of our first responders and especially our healthcare providers to learn a lot of things on the fly and to gain those best practices because we do have a very strong and a very resilient nation that has seen like some pretty serious disasters and other emergencies, you know, just even within the last, you know, 5 years. And so we are able to coordinate a lot of or work with a lot of lessons learned. And like I said, get all these different perspectives. When you bring in and coordinate and collaborate with all disciplines, really becomes and creates a very resilient community. And so it's really been essential in a lot of our responses and our activations. I don't know if you remember, we had that crazy incident. It was right before we activated for COVID, with that guy who was walking around with mercury and just and so that was, you know, yeah, a hazardous material. He was exposing a lot of people. We could have had like a real serious, like, you know, kind of mass casualty incident where, you know, people could be reporting to the hospitals and local clinics with, you know, severe symptoms, you know. And so we were really lucky that he just, yeah, found the mercury fascinating and was just playing with it on the, I shouldn't laugh at this, but he played with it on the McDonald's table.
Yeah, it just shows, yeah, that people just don't understand the severity of what they're,
yeah,
I'm sorry, go ahead. I was agreeing with
you. No, you're, you know, and and really, you know, that kind of brought to light, like, hey, what if this, you know, escalated into a bigger event? What if the, you know, some people had like nefarious intentions with this rather than, you know, this guy who thought it was just kind of cool. And luckily right. he didn't really suffer from, mercury poisoning, or any like severe symptoms. But I mean, that was, we had to bring in hazmat. We had to have our public health, folks on, standby, emergency medical services. And so when we were activated in our emergency operations center, where, you know, all the coordination happens with all of our departments within the city, we had a huge healthcare presence because, you know, we had to have our subject matter experts on hand, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, with situations like that, you've got to you got a public safety issue with, you know, potential exposures and contamination, but then you got to make sure your responders are safe, you know, as far as any necessary PPE or respirators, depending on the hazard and the threat. And yeah, enormous. And, you know, I'm certain that, you know, you remember is the, we were just talking about this the other day, the whole situation leading up to COVID-19 was almost surreal. It was that, you know, we went through the winter of 2019. We had the response to the underground contamination in the Fifth Ward. And then we had the water main break. And then we had mm-hmm. the Watson steel and grinding explosion with the polypropylene explosion. And then that went into and there was the mercury, and then COVID-19 just right after the other, one after the other. So yeah, it's always interesting how the world works. You know, it's makes you realize just how big the world is.
Well, yeah. And I mean, you know, also don't forget we have the Port of Houston. We have a lot of refineries, even though some of those aren't like within technically the Houston jurisdiction. We do have a lot of mutual aid agreements with Harris County and with some of those smaller jurisdictions that need our assistance. And so we did have that ITC explosion. We had another explosion. Let's see. I don't know if it was in Deer Park or Pasadena, but we had that huge. You may remember this, but the huge. I called it the plume of doom. So it was really freaky to see, and a lot of people were. You know, a lot of our residents were really freaked out about it. And unfortunately, it coincided with one of the highest pollen counts. And so people were having like all these allergies, but, you know, thought it was caused by this, you know, explosion in the plume that was, you know, headed towards Houston and going up north.
Yep.
So, yeah, I mean, even before COVID, we had that whole series of public health emergencies. And I mean, even with the water main break, we had a boil water notice, which, you know, you and I know is pretty significant when you're dealing with like this large of a population, and also with folks who may not have bottled water, you know, just like sitting around, unless it's right before hurricane season, which that was in January, I think, January or February. So, you know, we had to coordinate, get that bottled water, make sure that we had, you know, enough drinking water, that the schools were prepared, and other community centers. I mean, even though it was just a smaller area, nowhere significant as our boil water notice that was citywide. during the winter storm. But that was, I mean, that was incredible and just, you know, crazy, how we really had to rely, you know, on our public health, subject matter experts, how, you know, we had to work with, our first responders to, you know, check on our vulnerable populations, and, you know, to make sure that people weren't dying of carbon monoxide poisoning, because, you know, people were just trying to warm up or at least like warm up their house or make sure their children were safe or their pets. You know, a lot of people were seriously concerned about, you know, their animals. I mean, we learned that from Katrina, that people won't leave their animals and their pets behind. And so we had that whole, you know, significant event and happening with people who were, you know, weren't leaving because of their pets or weren't, you know, really weren't thinking clearly because they were just trying to stay warm, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. With safety, you know, it's interesting how everything correlates. You know, you've got these hazards, and like you said, you know, the hazards can all stack up very quickly, where you've got a natural disaster, and within that natural disaster, you've got the need to stay warm or the potential for dehydration and heat stress and heat stroke, or you've got a chemical exposure, or you've got biological exposures with either a virus or another pathogen or whatnot. And then you've got, if you have a need for sheltering, then you've got people within congregation, you know, during a pandemic. And then if you've got to do disinfection, you know, certain disinfectants like quaternary ammonium compounds, you know, those create chemical safety issues, and just a lot of preparedness going on there. So yeah, y'all definitely do a lot of great work there. It's always great to get to see everything come together to make sure those things keep everybody safe. So what I was curious about, so we talked about, you know, the work aspect of it. So you've got the emergency management, you've got the healthcare specific and the public health specific, you know, emergency support functions and all the different things that happen there to make sure that there's a proper subject matter expertise, and you've got the responders. And then we talked about these particular situations that definitely affect people, you know, not only at work and making sure people are safe doing their response and doing their jobs, but then you've got everybody at home. So like you said, you know, you've got the potential for carbon monoxide, or you've got the potential to freeze, or to, you know, for all of these different things that affect, or contaminated water supply. So what are some thoughts? What are some of your thoughts as far as what people can do for preparedness at home, so that if they have to go do a response or if they have to go to work during these hazards, they know that everything's taken care of back at home?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's like a really good question, and it is on everybody's mind. You know, we do. I mean, I'm considered a tier one employee. all of our first responders are. I think what's first and foremost is that everybody is aware that everybody has families or situations, homes, that they're going to have to attend to. And so it really starts with, you know, the employers or supervisors or whomever to, you know, take that into account when preparing for disasters. And so, you know, for Houston, for example, we have a plan outlined. Each of our departments has like a certain plan for their responders or their tier one employees to prepare their families and their homes prior to a disaster. So of course the disaster or the incidents that I'm talking about are natural disasters. We as Houston have to be constantly prepared for any sort of, you know, weather event, just living on the coast, it's very, you know, you never know what's going to happen. And so our hurricane season starts on June 4th and doesn't, you know, it just ended a few days ago on November 30th. And we have had like serious flooding and incidents up until like October and November. Houston has oddly had this weird voodoo, I'm not too sure, on holidays. You know, our freeze happened on Valentine's Day. We had a horrible flood on the 4th of July. We've had Halloween floods, Memorial Day floods, and of course, no one will forget the tax day floods, not necessarily a holiday, but pretty significant event. And we've had freezing weather with, you know, with MLK Day. So, any month with a holiday, I'm always on high alert with the, you know, while working with the city. But, you know, as far as like preparedness goes, personally, individually with your family, you know, we have a lot of websites and toolkits to assist our residents in preparing for an emergency. So, you know, it's having those supplies, and luckily every year prior to hurricane season, we do a huge severe or extreme weather ready expo where we give out like thousands of MREs, those meals ready to eat, cases of water and other preparedness, you know, items that are important, like the little kind of flashy lights so that you can connect that on your clothing so you'll be seen, document bags that are really sturdy, waterproof, that you can throw in your important documents like IDs, passports, birth certificates, stuff like that. And then of course, like stuff to, you know, checklists for medication or other specialized items, formula, diapers. We have a whole pet preparedness kit as well. And you know, so for those natural disasters, it is a little easier to prepare for those types of disasters, because you know it's kind of concrete. We have our best practices in set. We have what you know people should do for preparedness, and so I really want to stress that it is so important and so essential to know your neighbors. I think this day and age and in social media that we've got kind of disconnected with that face-to-face human contact. And it's really, really important to know your neighbors. I mean, there are people who can really, you know, help you and you can help them. You know, it kind of brings back that whole humanity, but you have people who, you know, may know how to fix a broken water pipe or know how to turn off, water with, you know, the water key or whatever, or have, some people, you know, may have electricity when you don't, or are able to give you wood for your, you know, fireplace in order to stay warm. And so it's really, really important, especially during cold weather, because you know, people, all the members in our community, I mean, we have a very, very large vulnerable population, and those are people with disabilities and access functional needs, but also we have a very large senior population. And so, you know, it's important to know your neighbors and to check on them, especially when you may lose power, because those are folks who could be dependent on that. And what we really learned during the, and I hate to keep bringing back the winter weather freeze, but we've really learned from that freeze is that we have a lot of people who are dependent on medical supplies. You know, like with dialysis, and we had a whole boil water notice, and we didn't have water pressure and electricity, and getting people's oxygen tanks refilled and stuff like that. So, you know, with any preparedness, it's really important to know your neighbors. It's really important to have that collaboration and coordination. We, as the Office of Emergency Management, do a lot of outreach to our communities. We participate in National Night Out. We also participate in any large expo, the mayor's back to school event that they do every year. And our sister office provides training to a very important group of people that are, you know, essential in our response and especially in our recovery. And they are called the Community Emergency Response Team, also known as CERT. And these are incredible people who are really dedicated to responding to emergencies and during the time of a disaster to help their neighbors. And these are folks in all over our community who are really interested in responding to any types of emergencies. And they get specialized training in volunteering at sheltering, at those points of distribution, like where you have those drive-through, you know, where you can pick up food and water, and like during Ike when we didn't have power for such a long period of time and it was just hot, you know, getting all that ice, and they get specialized training in first aid and just really being able to help their neighbors. The other important information or preparedness is knowing your evacuation route. And this can be for any reason. We could have a hazardous situation where we need to evacuate a particular neighborhood or even the city as a whole. That would be horrible, but you know, we have that, we are prepared. But also, you know, during a hurricane and knowing your evacuation route within your neighborhood. I mean, if somebody decides to, you know, hunker down or shelter in place in their home, knowing what, you know, knowing what roads and streets historically flood. And in Houston, as we know, a lot of our streets are meant for flooding because they are conduits. And so knowing what those are and just, you know, really staying abreast of, you know, the ever-changing situation, knowing those websites and those other tools that will help you in the time of a disaster. Knowing your health department, your local health department's website, and being able to navigate around that, knowing the National Weather Service site and how you can get up to minute information. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that the news media causes a lot of fear, but sometimes they aren't necessarily the best source of like particular information. I mean, the Weather Service has a site where you can actually put in your zip code or your address to find out like what the forecast is. And you know, during a hurricane, especially like one that was so huge as Harvey, the news media had a hard time, you know, catching up on who was getting flooded and reporting all that, because it was just like so widespread and everything was happening at once. And we got 62 inches of rain dumped on us, and it just seemed to be this never ending flooding. And so it was really important for people to stay up to date with, you know, what was going on in their neighborhood, because the city is massive and things were happening very quickly, and also not the same situations were happening on the northwest side of town as it was on the, you know, south side of town. So I hope that helps with some of the preparedness. It's a little bit more difficult, and a lot of people don't like to talk about situations where it's an active attacker or an active shooter. And there are a lot of tools and videos and trainings out there to help the community and individuals and families prepare for a situation like that. And unfortunately, it's becoming a lot more common. And honestly, I was one of those people who was like, oh, this won't happen. And I mean, we had a school shooting in Houston not that long ago. We didn't have a lot of casualties, but I mean, we lost a teacher. And we had that shooting in a church in Sutherland, Texas. And of course, that horrible travesty that happened in El Paso Walmart. So, you know, it's important to know what to do in a situation like that. And so, you won't be frozen to the spot and, you know, potential target. It's, that's a real like potential threat, no matter where you live or where you go. That's one that's like a little bit more difficult to talk about. But I know that local law enforcement are very adamant on teaching and training on run, hide, fight, and helping people prepare for a situation like that. So I hope that kind of, you know, covers like a lot of the preparedness, and response.
Oh, absolutely. No, that's great information. And yeah, you're definitely correct, is that, you know, it's one thing to recognize the potential for a natural disaster. But it's, you know, even in 2021, you know, almost 2022, and the tragic, you know, situations that have happened in the last decade or two decades, it's still difficult, you know, for humans to look at that, you know, at face value, that these active shootings and situations have happened, you know, repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we always, you know, within our safety, you know, we look at that methodically, you know, in terms of, you know, recognize the hazard, you know, create distance, call for support, you know, whether it's a panic button or 911 or whatnot. And then from there, if it's imminently dangerous, then like you said, you know, run, get away. If you can't do that, then find a place with cover and concealment. If you still can't do that, then, you know, find a makeshift weapon and do what you can to mitigate it. But it's tragic. Those things still happen. And hopefully we as a people, we can find a way to stop those things from happening. I think a better way to say it, but no, great input. We sure appreciate that.
Can I piggyback a little bit on that?
Yeah, please.
On what we were just talking about. And really, this is this is where it's essential to have these subject matter experts in healthcare. And we do not discuss enough with mental health. In emergency management, we have psychological first aid that we train on. We do realize that whenever there's a disaster, no matter what kind, we always have a trauma. And for first responders, it could be direct trauma, secondary trauma, and taking care of ourselves as responders. And we, you know, we're really fortunate in Houston in this region that when we had that horrible school shooting back in 2018 in Santa Fe, Texas, that we had folks immediately deploy to respond to the mental health crisis with our first responders, as well as going to those family assistance centers and responding to those and working with those families and survivors that were suffering some severe mental health situations and trauma, and being able to follow up with that. I saw this in Vegas, and it really kind of touched me about how, even though that shooting took place in 2017, October 1st of 2017, and it was horrific and affected us like nationwide, it's so easy, if we weren't directly impacted, to forget that and really moving on. And Vegas, you know, hasn't. And it is still really prevalent there. They hosted the Homeland Security Conference this year, and I had the opportunity to go, and it was amazing experience. But it was really incredible to work with and see those folks who were part of that response, how they've been recovering from it, and what is the continued recovery on that, and that they still have facilities and clinics open to help treat a lot of the continuing mental health issues when it comes to, you know, situations like that. We don't really focus on that enough. I mean, I'm really glad that a lot of people are talking a lot more about like mental health and really, you know, kind of focusing on that. But, you know, after a disaster, it's really a huge part of our recovery and being a resilient community, but having those services offered. So what kind of sparked what I was thinking about when you were talking about or when we were kind of discussing like an active shooter is that a lot of these or what Run, Hide, Fight is basically about and what a lot of folks in the workforce and especially like people who work in large buildings or very stressful situations, you know, our oil industry especially, to be prepared for workplace violence. And the original Run, Hide, Fight video is about an office shooting. And I talked about this when I spoke to the National Safety Council, I think, a few months ago. It was in, did a whole kind of section on mental health and being aware of the people you work with, the people you associate with, and kind of helping with that prevention. And we have in our mental health providers here, you know, give training on suicide prevention, and I really think that is another kind of preparedness tool that people can use. And And it is uncomfortable to talk about, and it is uncomfortable to look at, and it's also awkward to think that there may be somebody in our lives that we need to approach and say, like, hey, I, you know, care about you, or I'm concerned about you, and bringing that up to someone that, you know, there may be concerns about, like, feeling that they might be suicidal or harm themselves or harm somebody else. And so that's like a big part of the preparedness or prevention of, you know, these types of attacks. I mean, whenever we see, and it's always in hindsight, and looking at a lot of the school shootings and mass shootings, these people had like serious mental issues. You know, it wasn't like they woke up and thought it was a good idea to, you know, shoot up a movie theater. And I'm certainly not blaming the community or anybody close to these people that they didn't, you know, maybe pick up on these breadcrumbs or signs that, you know, could have been like this person was going to snap. But now that we've learned these lessons, like, we as individuals can be more aware of like our surroundings and people. And so I really wanted to talk about that. Sorry, I probably took up way too much time, but I think it's a very, very important aspect of not only preparing for disasters, but our recovery too, is taking care of like the mental health.
It's great. I totally agree. It's interesting. I'm actually doing a webinar tomorrow for Safety and Health Magazine, and it's about workplace violence and the whole dichotomy of risk, you know, ranging from a patient slapping a nurse all the way to a bomb threat or a dirty bomb or a C-burn attack. And of course, active shooter is, you know, on the far right side of that scale. And within any of those situations, like you said, you know, there's a huge need for the mental side of the preparedness, you know, to recognize any indicators. And then also the mental side of the response with like critical incident stress debriefings. And you know, in the case of employers, they have their employee assistance programs, and then all of these different aspects they extend well beyond the, you know, the on-scene first aid and trauma care and whatnot. So there's a lot to be looked at there, and I'm hoping that as we proceed through history, you know, we're able to see less of these situations, because they're certainly tragic. Kind of speaking of that, this is the question I always ask everybody, each of our podcast guests, and I'm always interested in the answers for sure. So if you had a magic wand, so if you could change something about emergency management or about safety or healthcare, public health, any kind of contingency response, training, equipment, anything at all, if you could wave that magic wand, what would you want to change?
Yeah, so I loved that question. And when I was reading it, I was like, I know exactly how to answer it. I would like to have the wand of equity. It is so painful to see the inequity in our city. I saw it a lot when I worked, you know, with the homeless, of course, but I still see it today when, you know, we have like families who are unable or don't have the resources to be prepared for a disaster, who don't have the extra income to have canned food and water and other non-perishables like on hand in case stores are closed or whatnot. And we really saw that with COVID. And I've been really involved with our supply chain, and our healthcare partners have been involved with that as well. And it's been very interesting to see that such a wealthy city as Houston, such a diverse city, such a large metropolitan area, has not only do we have food deserts, but we also have this huge digital divide, and we have huge neighborhoods that didn't have the technology, the resources, or even the internet and bandwidth capable for people to work from home, for kids to attend school. And it breaks my heart. It also is very frustrating for, you know, someone in my position who's like, hey, rallying, you know, be prepared, have this, you know, do this, this is what you need to do. And, you know, having those people and those families, those individuals who don't have those resources, and being able to reach out to them in a lot of different, you know, ways. We've had to be very nimble and flexible and creative in our response with COVID, and preparing for hurricane season, with helping, you know, all vulnerable populations and those populations who, you know, are economically unequal, you know. And so, yeah, my wand would be the wand of equity.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's a great magic wand move. You know, it's interesting. We were just talking about something similar. I was speaking with I was doing a panel for the National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences, and we were talking about COVID-19 in schools. And one of the points I was making is that when, you know, in the absence of regulations, then it becomes an individual choice of each organization as far as what they do as far as risk management, you know, whether it's going to be risk avoidance, which would be, you know, telecommuting, virtual education, et cetera, or you've got in the middle, you've got risk control, which is what we're doing, you know, as far as capacity management, social distancing, face cover, source control, and hygiene, disinfection, all the full gamut of exposure prevention, which I know you're very familiar with. And then on the right side, you've got your risk acceptance, which is where people say, well, you know, for whatever reason, you know, there's a lot of reasons for this, but you have organizations where they'll say, you know, we're not concerned, we're going to go about business as usual. And if exposures happen, then exposures happen. And so the point I was making is that if you have a school and it's their decision and the principal or the superintendent says, we're going with risk acceptance, you know, we're just going to go ahead and bring everybody in, and if exposures happen, then exposures happen, then it's so important to be transparent about that. Because if you're a parent, then, you know, you want to know that's the way it's going to be, you know, when your student goes to school there, is they're not going to have distancing, they're not going to have face covers, they're not going to have any of those controls. And the reason that's important to talk about is because if you're a parent and the principal says, you know, we're not going to have any controls, that's what you get, and the parent doesn't like that, if there's not the equity where the parent has the ability and the opportunity to say, like, well, I don't want my child to go to school there, so I need to pull them out and find another path for education, that's not possible for a lot of people. You know, they don't have that kind of equity to where they have the opportunity to pull the kid out of school and find another way to educate them. So they're kind of, I hate to use the word, but they're kind of stuck with the choice of the organization, whether they like it or not. So if their risk acceptance is chosen, even if the parent doesn't agree with that, if they don't have the ability to find another path, then that organization's risk acceptance becomes that person's risk acceptance, whether they like it or not. So I totally hear what you're saying about equity and the need for that is it extends far beyond those initial conversations for sure. It comes into questions of, well, how much free will do you really have? You know, if you don't have those opportunities and those resources. So great answer. I appreciate you bringing that up. Heck, I know. Great discussion today. I sure appreciate your time and all your insights.
Yeah. Thanks. This is my first podcast, so I'm really excited. I did have one thing more to add, and this
please.
Is just for a quick second. But please, everybody, remember you cannot always rely on the government to help respond, prepare, and recover from. A disaster. You know, FEMA is not always going to be there. It, you know, every disaster starts locally, and it is our individual responsibility to prepare and to help with that response. But, you know, get flood insurance, have a kit, have a plan. You know, be aware of your surroundings, but, you know, that kind of stuff. Because, you know, it is an individual's responsibility to be prepared for our disasters. And we can't always rely on the government bailing us out, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Is same principle with safety, definitely, is that you know, each organization and each community, you know, they'll certainly look out for hazards and safety protocols and everything. But ultimately, you know, each individual needs to look for those hazards. And if they're not sure of the safe action to take, then that's a good opportunity to ask the question and figure out how to go about things. It ultimately happens in real time. Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's great input. That's actually the last thing I was going to ask you. Is anything else you'd like to add today before we wrap it up?
No. Thanks. This was such a treat. I'm sorry I went over.
No, you're all good. We don't have any time allotments. I appreciate your time. I know you're very busy. So we're honored that you dedicated some time to us today, but we'll get everything up on our ASSP Health Beat podcast, and I'll send you the link and everything. For everybody listening, if you haven't seen it yet, check out our podcast page. We're at anchor.fm/ASSP-HCPS-HealthBeat. We have. Oh, goodness. I'm not sure the number now. We have, I think, 26 episodes. We just published a 7-part series with a lot of different a lot of different practice specialties from ASSP. So we have a conversation with environmental and a conversation with ergonomics and a conversation with industrial hygiene. And then we have a conversation with BICE, the Blacks in Safety Excellence. And we have a conversation with WICE, the Women in Safety Excellence. So definitely check those out. And then also we have some webinars that are going to be coming up in the winter. So be on the lookout for that. We're aiming to do our next webinar in February, and that's going to be about empathy. So we're going to be partnering with the ergonomics practice specialty and talking about empathy. And then if anybody's interested, I'll actually be doing a webinar with the National Safety Council about workplace violence prevention. And that's going to be coming up. So you can find that on Safety and Health Magazine. And if you missed the live version, they'll do a replay as always on demand.
So with all that being said, we appreciate everybody listening today, and we will catch everybody real soon. Have a great day.